Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the first concurrent of the Injury Scheme Seminar. This one is Measuring and Building Wellbeing and Resilience of Scale to Achieve Health Outcomes. I'm John Killick from SKL, and I'm chairing this session. So I have a few reminders that have been drilled into me to make sure that I pass on to you. Your feedback forms, you'll hear this everywhere, I'm sure, the whole time. Those feedback forms are both beneficial for the Institute to test the quality or otherwise of the seminar, but also for the organising committee to know what you like, what you don't like, what works, what doesn't work for ongoing organisation. So let me introduce you to our speaker today. Monique's going to talk us through this, and there's time at the end for questions. If you want to ask a question, please stand up and use the microphone, and please state your name and your organisation, because this is being recorded. So let's kick off. Monique Newbury. Monique is a project lead at the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre within the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, SAHMRI. Monique has 10 years of experience in professional services and management consulting, working with organisations in various industries across the private, public and community sectors. She is a chartered accountant, and in recent years her work has focused on people and organisational change, in particular leading projects that measure and build well-being and resilience in order to shift the population curve toward optimum mental health and thereby reduce the individual, social and economic impact of mental illness. So please welcome Monique.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for joining me this morning. Check that this is all working. So just a brief overview of what I'll be talking about today. So I'll give you a bit of a background of where I'm from and the SAMRI Wellbeing and Resilience Centre for those that aren't based in South Australia. Just thought it would be worth giving you a bit of that background. I'll be talking about our PermaPlus wellbeing framework, what we use to measure and build wellbeing in our projects. Also our approach to lead, measure, build and embed wellbeing and resilience across the population. Then I will talk a bit about the case study, the US Army large-scale resilience intervention, which is where we are getting a lot of our learnings and basing part of our approach on. And we'll hear from some of our project participants, some video clips of some of our project participants. And then hopefully we'll have some time for questions. So who is based in Adelaide? Anyone in this room? Right, so you would recognise this building. Those of you who aren't based in Adelaide, this is our new flagship research institute on North Terrace. It's next to where our new Royal Adelaide Hospital is being built, and it's going to form part of a new biomedical precinct in Adelaide. So this is the, you know, some people affectionately call it the cheese grater or the pineapple, or there's many names for it, but this is SAMRI. So this is our new research institute. It's a collaboration of all of our each of our universities, and it was established in 2009. So I will give you a bit of background as to SAMRI and also my role within SAMRI and the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre, which is housed within SAMRI. So SAMRI's mission, I guess, is to translate research into health outcomes. There are seven research themes: Aboriginal health, infection and immunity, heart health, cancer, healthy mothers, babies and children, nutrition and metabolism, and mind and brain. So within the mind and brain research theme, we have, as part of that theme, we have the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre. And that's the centre which I work for. So we are housed within the mind and brain research theme. But we will also be collaborating with other research themes, including nutrition, cancer, heart health, to explore the links between wellbeing and resilience and those other research themes and the impact on cancer or the link between nutrition and wellbeing, for example. So we will be working with other research themes as well. So that's just a bit of background as to where our team is housed. So our vision at the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre, which is within SAMRE, is to build a positive mental health and wellbeing for a resilient society. So we are doing this through our lead measure, build, embed and research approach, and that is including positioning South Australia as the state of wellbeing, although we don't only work with South Australians, we are then looking to take this work nationally and globally, so just to, because I know many of you aren't in South Australia. We are doing that by measuring the wellbeing of each group that we work with and then building wellbeing and resilience in those groups through interventions, and I'll talk a bit about what interventions we're using, and then embedding that knowledge for long-term sustainability, and we are, wrapping research around that whole process so that everything we do is evidence-based and is based on scientific rigour. So that's something really important to us in quite a new area. We want to make sure everything we are doing is backed by science, and that's part of being part of a research institute. And we are working across organisations, public sector agencies, in schools, so from young people right through to older people aged over 65. So we have a number of projects that are applying our approach into all different cohorts across the life course. So I'll talk a bit more about the approaches that we're using and the applicability that it has across different sectors and across different age groups. So part of being in the mind and brain theme, so the mind and brain theme within SAMRE focuses on the whole spectrum of mental health. So looking at treatments for mental illnesses, and then the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre is focused on the other side of the spectrum, which is building optimum wellbeing and optimum and looking at what makes us function at our best capacity. So the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre, we are not replacing clinical intervention. We are not we're not looking so much at treating mental illness or those who are suffering, but really looking at how can we move people from, say, -2 to +10. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. How do we move people up the scale? Not so much how do we treat those who are already suffering. So being part of the mind and brain theme also allows us to interact with other areas of science, including neuroscience, neuroplasticity. So again, the strength of being in SAMRE and the strength of being in the mind and brain theme means that we can work with these other modalities as well. So for those who aren't South Australian, but you may not know who this man is, this is our Premier, Premier Jay Weatherill, and this is a statement he made at our launch earlier this year, which where he says, and what else are we striving for if it's not for the wellbeing of all of our citizens? So he's a key champion of the work we are doing, and it's good to see that politicians and business leaders are also getting behind this work, and also around the globe. So we know that in the UK, David Cameron is also a huge champion of the work around measuring wellbeing and building wellbeing in Bhutan, in other places around the world. So we're seeing a real movement towards going beyond GDP and beyond traditional measures of progress, and looking at using wellbeing as to evaluate public policy and to evaluate business decisions and other key decisions. Okay, so just with a bit of that background, so some of the, key challenges that, to step back and say, how did we get to where we are? So how did the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre come about? How did this movement in South Australia start off? Now, I'm sure many of you are aware of the key statistics around mental health, around psychological injury claims, so I won't mention these for too long, but I guess we all know that one in two Australians will suffer a mental illness in their life and one in five adults each year. We know that that's one in four young Australians each year, so slightly more than the one in five adults. We know that life expectancy for those suffering mental illness is lower than those who aren't suffering. We know that from a cost perspective and an economic cost, we know that that the cost is 12% of GDP and it's a large cost to the economy. We also know from an organisational perspective that productivity is compromised, and not only productivity but also many other organisational KPIs around absenteeism, presenteeism, etc. So we know the cost to organisations is very high, and that includes psychological injury claims. So this is taken from some statistics in South Australia, where we've seen that the increase over the past 4 years in the number of psychological claims has grown at a rapid rate compared to non-psychological injury claims. So these were just some of the things we were seeing that we thought, okay, what can we do about this? So about 4 years ago, the South Australian government, actually, before I go on, this is just a couple of other slides just to further support what I was saying. These tables come from the National Mental Health Commission report. So this is just showing the expenditure on mental health over the years is rising at a rapid rate, but we're not seeing that the outcomes are changing. So the spend continues to be disproportionately focused on treatment, which is necessary, and again, we're not stating that treatment should not occur or that this is a replacement for treatment, but the Australian government now acknowledges that there is evidence to suggest that if we focused some of that investment on preventative measures and on building resilience, that we could see positive outcomes in mental health. So I guess the question that was posed was, could the science of wellbeing, resilience and positive psychology reduce mental illness and build population mental health? And to start to answer this question, the South Australian government, we had a Thinkers in Residence program where we would focus on a cause or a question and bring a global thought leader to Adelaide for a couple of years to engage with government, community, business, and explore an area. So we had Martin Seligman was our Thinkers in Residence for 2012 and 13. He is a psychologist, but he is known as the founder of positive psychology. So some of you may or may not be aware of Martin Seligman's work. And he is, I guess, the first psychologist to say traditional psychology is focused on what isn't right or what isn't going right with an individual. How about we focus on the science of what makes life worth living and how can we improve people's lives and build on people's strengths? So Martin Seligman, it was a very successful residency. He engaged with tens of thousands of people in South Australia, and including political leaders and business leaders. And his key message to us was that wellbeing is measurable, teachable and learnable. That was one of his key statements and key messages, and really, I guess, a call to action for us to now do something with this information. We'll hear a bit from us.
A couple of years ago, I waved the banner that 51% of the world's adults should be flourishing by 2051 by positive psychology criteria. So what's needed is for well-being to be on the political agenda and, more importantly, to be in the warp and woof of a community. That a community is about increasing the well-being of the individuals in it. And what being in South Australia opens the question of, how do you go from individual well-being, which we now know how to measure, and even something about how to build, so how do you do this for an entire community or an entire state?
So Martin left us with a lot to consider and a lot to think about as to how to move forward. We've also taken inspiration and learnings from other global leaders in this space. So, for example, in the neuroscience area, Dr. Norman Deutsch says the brain is not fixed and unchangeable, but can create new neural pathways to adapt to its needs. So we know that we can have interventions that can change the brain and the neural pathways. So we've started to look at various global leaders in research in the areas of positive psychology, neuroscience, and resilience. And this is just another display of what I mean by shifting the population curve. So we've got, from mental disorder through to flourishing. So really we're looking at how to shift people up the curve towards flourishing. And how can we do that at a population level? So following Martin Seligman's residency is really where the Wellbeing and Resilience Centre was established, to take on his recommendations and the information that he provided and to start to implement his recommendations throughout South Australia and also moving nationally and globally as well, but starting off with South Australia as an initial case study, I guess, or an initial initial pilot. So the framework that we are using is named PERMA Plus. So PERMA, which I'll describe, PERMA stands for positive emotion, engagement, relationships, meaning and accomplishment. Now PERMA is a research framework that Martin Seligman developed. It's a dashboard for wellbeing and resilience where he says if you build on each of those elements, you will increase your wellbeing. And there's a lot of research that goes with each of those elements, which I'll explain a little bit more about. And the plus that we have added through consultation with other experts is the physical element. So we know that we can't separate the body and the mind when it comes to holistic well-being, so that our physical activity, nutrition and sleep has a huge impact and something we can't ignore. So we have combined the two to result in a PERMA Plus framework. Now, there are many different ways of measuring well-being and many different, an OECD framework, a World Health Organization framework. There are many other frameworks. The reason why we initially chose to stick with the PERMA framework, not just because Martin Seligman was an advisor, but that wasn't the reason why we stuck with it. We weren't wedded to that. But for a population health approach, we know that PERMA is easy to understand and remember. So we have school children who are being taught the PERMA framework and telling their parents about what PERMA is. They understand what PERMA stands for, what it means, and it also carries a how-to and you know what to do through the PERMA framework. So that was really through consultation with various groups, we thought it had it was quite a powerful message for a population health approach. So the lead, measure, build, embed framework, just to bring up, we use this for each of our projects. So as an example, we're working on about four projects at the moment. One is with older South Australians, those aged over 65. We're working with a group of youth who aren't in employment, aren't in training, aren't in school. We are working with organisations. So we're working across the life course, but this is the framework we use in each of those settings. We adapt and tailor the framework and the steps involved, but we start off with the lead phase, which is getting leadership on board or the community leaders to set the communication strategy and the change management strategy, to plan who will be the participants. So the lead phase is really around the original buy-in and also detailed planning up front before we commence the rest of the project. So we do that before we measure. So we move into the measure phase, which is obtaining a baseline measurement of the group that we're working with. So there is a validated PermaPlus survey where an individual can complete that survey and get a PermaPlus score, effectively, of where they are at. So we always baseline measure before we implement interventions. We move into the build phase, where that is really around teaching the knowledge, teaching the groups the new resilience skills. And then after that, we come back and repeat the measurement. So we'll measure, implement the interventions, repeat measure, and evaluate what the impact was to that group. And then the embed phase, which we have incorporated there, is very important to us because we don't want this just to be an end-to-end project without long-term behaviour change or sustainable change to the participants. So then we look at how to really embed the new knowledge into the participants' lives for long-term change. So I mentioned earlier the US Army experience, which is where we've taken a lot of our learnings from. So I'll talk a little bit about the US Army experience because the interventions that we are implementing, we are using initially the trainers and the interventions that were applied across the US military. So the US Army is a large-scale intervention, possibly the largest-scale resilience intervention. So when we were doing a global scan of where has this been done, but not only where has this been done, where has it been evaluated and shown to be positive, successful outcomes? And the US Army example is one in which over 1.1 million soldiers have been involved in this program, and that's close to the population of South Australia. So even though South Australia is a democracy and it's not a command and control organisation such as the military, we thought that there was great value in using the learnings and seeing whether we could adapt that to a democratic context. So this particular large-scale intervention, the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program, so they realised that they were only, back in about 2006, where there were, you know, rising statistics around post-traumatic stress disorder and a number of other adverse statistics. General Casey of the US military said, we do nothing for psychological fitness. We do nothing to prepare our soldiers before they go to battle, apart from preparing them physically. So they recognised this and knew that they wanted to do something about it. And that's where the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program commenced. And their tagline was physically fit, mentally tough and emotionally strong. Whereas previously they admitted that they had mainly focused on the physically fit part of that. So we'll hear a little bit from, and this lady, Brigadier General Rhonda Cornham, she led this initiative. And we'll hear a little bit from her now.
Well, we started developing psychological fitness in the Army back in about 2008, when we realized that our current strategy of just finding and treating disease was important but not sufficient. So we have a long history, 200 years, of doing physical training and building people's physical strength and endurance, but we didn't have a psychological health and fitness training program. We really did nothing to strengthen people, essentially, unless they were just about to deploy, which is the worst time to try to learn something. So General Casey decided very intelligently that we should have a progressive, sequential training program to build emotional and social and spiritual fitness, starting from when people came in the Army, so that whenever they were faced with some kind of challenge, they would be more likely to be successful in facing it.
So I'll talk through some of the outcomes that they've seen following a rigorous evaluation, but one of the studies that I'll walk you through is this particular one, which is quite interesting. So US Navy recruits were assessed psychologically for depression, perceived stress, loneliness, coping style. They were then, according to those results, they were split into the upper 75 and the lower 75 of psychological fitness, I guess, or based on that psychological assessment. The upper 75 went on to receive normal recruit training. The lower 25% of psychological health was split into normal training as well as normal training plus an additional round of weekly resilience training. So what they saw from this, firstly, is that recruits that were separated, so recruits that went home and did not make it through the through to completion of that training, so 7% of the lower 25% group, so this was the control group who did not receive the additional resilience modules. So there were more of that group that that did not make it through to completion. And you can see the lower 25% who did receive the resilience module fared the same as the upper 75% of those who were already assessed as having high psychological health or high psychological fitness. So I guess this group really became similar to those with, I guess their outcomes were similar to those with higher psychological health to begin with. And that's also shown in this graph where those who completed the recruit training, again, the lower 25% who received the additional resilience module had similar and I believe actually slightly higher outcomes of completion to the original upper 75%. So that was just one of the particular studies that was conducted with the resilience training for the US Navy. Now, overall, across the US Army, the benefits that they... the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program, which consisted of measurement and interventions, underwent rigorous evaluation. And out of that evaluation, they saw the outcomes of increased social fitness, organisational trust, optimism, adaptability, positive coping, less catastrophic thinking, and the key outcomes that they saw... which were statistically relevant, were the lower depression, anxiety, PTSD, substance abuse problems. And we've also seen in our other research around resilience that higher resilience also leads to physical health outcomes around lower blood pressure, better sleep, higher immune function, and longer lifespan. So these are some of the I guess, outcomes that we are... I guess we've seen in other studies that we are now looking to incorporate in our research to see whether the programs that we implement, whether we do see these similar outcomes. So the interventions which we often get asked about, the interventions that we're currently using in our projects, we're actually using the trainers to the US military. They're currently in South Australia at the moment teaching a large group of over 100 South Australians. So because we're quite new in our research and in our projects, we are calling on their expertise. And then we will eventually transition to an Australian group of trainers. But we are using Rhonda Cornham and her team to deliver the same or similar set of interventions that they use. And it's based on strengths research, fixed and growth mindset, gratitude, grit, mindfulness. Also builds on the fields of cognitive behavioural therapy, acceptance commitment therapy, positive psychology. So there are a number of modalities that have been based on, and the US Army training program underwent years of development. So we are now drawing on those expertise rather than reinventing the wheel altogether. So one of the projects that I thought I would mention, which I mentioned briefly, our ageing project and youth projects earlier, but we are working with a couple of organisations in the auto manufacturing industry. So for those of you who know in South Australia, the auto industry is closing, so Holden will be leaving South Australia, which leaves a number of people out of work. And not just those who work for Holden, but also these two organisations are Tier 1 suppliers to Holden. So Holden is their main customer. They will also be closing as a result. So we are working with the employees of Futurus and HeroTech to lead, measure, build and embed resilience in their lives before they are out of the job in a year or 2 years' time. So this is one, I guess, live project that we are undertaking at the moment. We are in the phase of finishing delivering the interventions, and we are about to re-measure and evaluate to see what some of the outcomes for that particular group may be. And just to hear a little bit to finish off from some of the participants of this group.
I'm a supervisor of 75 people, so this opportunity for me to pass this on to my operators is a really good experience for me, to go back to these guys and show them you can get through the tough times quite easy if you're strong-minded.
For me, the most important thing is that it is something you can learn. It's not, you don't have to be born a certain way. You can actually, you know, learn those skills. Doesn't matter where you're educated, what your education level is. So at any level, you can learn those skills, and they will, you know, help you in life.
I'm seeing some of our people grow a little bit in this course as well, which is really good for their personal development. I think they were apprehensive initially about what the course was about. They thought it might have been airy-fairy. But at the end of the day, they're coming back and saying it's given them some really practical skills.
It's pretty clear fairly quickly that there's value in what we're being trained in. Like I said, in everyday life we can use these skills, not just in the big picture moments.
Yeah, so even if your company's thriving and growing, these skills are really what you can use from day to day in your business, and I believe that they will make your business more profitable. Make you the people in the workplace closer together, and that when there is a adverse situation, people can deal with it better.
One of the key things we're learning is about an event and how to slow down your thought process in that event and react differently. So in everyday situations, that's going to be a benefit.
I mean, I'm the type of person that wants to try and help people, and I believe in, especially in northern suburbs, there's going to be quite a lot of people that are going to need some help and some support. And if I can deliver this training, and not necessarily that people may not pick up the 8 skills, but if they at least pick up 2 skills, I think they're going to be better off finding a new job, but also they're going to be better off at home with other people. You know, the whole life hopefully can improve.
I can't speak highly enough of this. It's helped me out. Like, I couldn't believe how much it's going to help me out.
One of the key things I always think about when I listen to that is the gentleman that says, Martin, it doesn't matter who you are or what your background is or your education level, anyone can learn these skills. And I think that was a key takeaway for us, to see how they were picking up on the new knowledge that they were learning. So I guess to finish off this presentation, to summarise... we know that wellbeing and resilience can be measured and taught, can be learned. The brain is not fixed. Anyone at any age can learn to boost their wellbeing and resilience and positive mental health. Evidence shows the link between wellbeing and resilience to physical and mental health outcomes, as well as organisational outcomes such as productivity, performance. And the lead, measure, build and embed approach, which uses validated measures and evidence-based interventions, can be tailored and scaled to the varying needs of different groups. So we're hoping to see some beneficial outcomes as a result of our work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Monique. I found that very interesting and actually quite comforting that people are thinking and organising things along these lines, especially since we're probably all aware of the changes happening in the automotive industry here, which is potentially quite catastrophic for the communities. Now, please, questions at all? Please don't forget to state your name and organisation and use the microphone, but any questions? Yes, at the back, please. There's a microphone just up here, if you wouldn't mind using that. Sorry.
My name is Natalie. and I'm from the TAC in Victoria. I'm not sure if I missed it, but I just was really interested to know what are the actual measures and tools that, or the tools that you're using to measure well-being and resilience.
Hello. Yep, you can hear me. So the measure that we're using is a validated survey of around 50 questions that participants complete, and it's based on the PERMA Plus framework. So that is the and then a score is then calculated as a result of the questions that the person answers. So in all of our projects, we baseline the PERMA Plus of each individual. We give them a confidential individual report so that they have the knowledge about them individually.
That's 5 minutes.
And then we also aggregate the results to see how the whole group, where the group is at as well. So that's a PERMA Plus questionnaire survey.
Okay, so is that, so you said it's standardised, is it regularly available, like can you purchase it or is it
Yeah, so the PERMA questionnaire is publicly available information because that's Martin Seligman's framework.
Yeah.
We've added some additional constructs to pull together the PERMA Plus. I guess it includes the physical domains as well.
Yeah.
But I'd be happy to, if anyone would like to take my contact details and have any questions after this, I'd be happy to share with you some of that information.
Great. Thanks, Monique.
Has anyone else got any other questions on that? Because that touched on a question I had. Is the how long has the you know with the people on the last video,
yes.
The automotive industry, the elder, more mature people that you've been working on. How long has that been going in terms of time?
So that has been just over a year.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, so just over a year. The one with the younger people, has it been going as long?
Well, our centre has been established for just over a year.
Oh, right.
So I guess we're still, basically, by this time next year, we would have completed the first round of evaluation and repeat measures for all of our projects. So that's when we can come back and say, this is what we're seeing and finding. And we're already finding many things, even from the baseline measure, but what we're really interested in is the repeat measure and the evaluation.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be interested in some of the potential differences between the more mature group.
Of course, and school and, children.
And the children, the younger people,
yes.
Because you see a lot of people, you know, displaced people, youth in Western Sydney and other areas, and people are talking about some of what they're doing with their idle time, and whether it's for good or bad. It'd be very interesting to see how that engages and how it could be utilised elsewhere.
Yeah, and the research shows that the benefits can particularly be higher with young people.
Mm.
So that, but that's not to say that anyone at any age can't improve their well-being, but often the research has shown that there is greater potential for a younger cohort because they are still, you know, forming their habits and learning pathways. But it will be interesting for us to compare the groups.
Yeah. Is there anybody else in Australia doing this type of research?
So I think there are. We know that so Melbourne University are really strong in the education and youth focus,
yes.
And younger people. As far as across, or we're not aware of those that are doing it on the scale that we're doing it, and across all the life course. So we know of pockets of where this is happening in organisations or in schools. But I'm not aware of, I guess, the population approach.
That's good. Question, please.
Hello, my name's Yusuf from iCare Self Insurance. Look, I'm not quite familiar with this scheme with the US Army, for example. Do they have something like a common law benefit at the end of their injury or you know, in New South Wales, we've got DND, which is it's a system that was designed to provide safety net, but at the same time, it can also be seen as a disincentive to getting better. So have you got any thought on that? Or
so your question, sorry, is around whether this could be a disincentive? Is that what you...
Well, I mean, I just want to know, the result that you've shown there is really good, but in terms of the system in America that provide for injured
Well, that was that was across the all U.S. soldiers, so
that's
it wasn't
correct.
Injured. It wasn't just those. It wasn't a treatment for those that were injured. It was a preventative psychological fitness approach across everyone in the U.S. military.
Sure, but you had stats that say the separation where the upper 75% was only 1%, where the separation is due to. Psychological injury, is that correct? Or
no, so that was splitting them. So all the new recruits were assessed for their baseline psychological fitness.
Sure.
And they were split into upper 75 and lower 25. And the lower 25 who received resilience training then fared as well as those who were originally in the upper 75. But we can talk more after, because I may not be understanding your specific question.
So please, thank you for your question, and we do need to stick to time. But everybody, I would like to thank Monique for her input. I think it was very valuable.
Thank you.